First of all, I thank Lee very much for taking class last week. He covered chapters 13 and 14. I heard from several people, and Lee again this evening, they did just a great job, and so I'm not going to be rehearsing or reviewing any of that material at all this evening, except to say I'm going to have just a couple of slides here, as those are the first two chapters of a very clear section in the book. So I just want to point that out, remembering that the two biggest sections in the book from last few weeks, we mentioned it, are the first 39 chapters, which therefore there are 39 books of the Old Testament. It's easy to see and remember. And then Isaiah 40 through 66, which happens to be 27 chapters, and there's 27 books in the New Testament. And so while there is nothing in Scripture that would say that God intended this, and seeing that the book existed for what would be 2,000 years before chapters were invented into the Bible, the first two millenniums, nobody could see this. I think it's just coincidental and not intentional by God, but it is a helpful kind of a memory trick, because by and large, the first 39 books, like the Old Testament, deal primarily with Old Testament times, as we'll be seeing particularly here this evening. And then the 27 books that are the 40 through 66 have more of the messianic and church age kind of material in them. There's both in each section, so it's not exclusive by any means, but it is just kind of a handy memory trick. Now, ultimately, I'm still wrestling with how much of an outline to be giving you and then forcing you under penalty of paying me large sums of money if you flunk the test and can't remember these truths right here. No. But roughly, Isaiah's first five chapters are about Jerusalem and Judah. They're directed at Jerusalem and Judah. They deal with Old Testament materials and time of Isaiah materials and thereafter. They also deal with messianic materials. But you can look at the first five chapters as being information, whether it's going to be fulfilled soon in Isaiah's time or much later in the establishment of the church, particularly with chapter 2. These first five chapters are about Jerusalem and Judah. Isaiah 6, of course, everybody remembers. It is the one chapter next to Isaiah 53, I suppose, that everybody remembers as Isaiah's call, "Here am I, send me." And so Isaiah there speaks of a time when God asks for one who will preach. And one who will preach in hard times, one who will preach when nobody's going to pay any attention, but he'll preach anyway. And so Isaiah 6 just stands out as a part of Isaiah's personal history. And then, with Lenny's class last week, we began a new section, but 7 through 12 is clearly an independent section itself. So chapter 7 through 12 we were calling the Emmanuel prophecies. Now once again, it's not exclusively that. In fact, the word only appears a couple of times in those chapters, but by and large, commentators have looked at the material and said, well, you know, we do see the prominence of Emmanuel here. So we're going to call these the Emmanuel prophecies. And I broke it down, you know, into three subgroups and some of those into even smaller parcels. So chapter 7 through 12 is Emmanuel prophecies, but there's talk there about Assyrian invasion. There's talk there about Assyrian destruction because they're asking for it. There's talk about the 10 northern tribes called Israel, or also called Ephraim, or also called Samaria. Those 10 northern tribes, whichever the three names that you want to pick, they get addressed in the midst of 7 through 12. And then even Assyria does, which is not a part of the nation of Israel at all. So I just want to emphasize, these are broad stroke outlines and groupings to help you generally find your way around inside the book of Isaiah. It's got 66 chapters. It is Isaiah's prophecies of at least 40 years of his life, maybe as much as 60. It's big. So as you break it down, you can say 1 to 6 if you like, though 6 is so unique. 7 to 12, it's Emmanuel prophecies, but there is messianic stuff throughout the book. There is historical information throughout the book, and there are prophecies about Gentile nations throughout the book. So there's a lot of overlapping that goes on. Now then, with Lenny's class last week, you entered into Isaiah chapters 13 through 23. Very obviously a unique standout group. We'll call this the nations, plurals most important, the nations prophecies. This section, 13 through 23, 11 chapters, is going to speak first of Babylon. Lenny dealt with it last week. Philistia, which was also in the material Lenny talked about. Moab, which is chapter 15 and 16, we're going to talk about in just a minute. Damascus, which is the capital city of Syria, frequently in Scripture referred to as what four-letter word starts with A? It's not Ahab. That's so funny what happens in the human mind. Somebody said Ahab, and instantly my head went, Ahab, the Arab kingdom. Somebody remember that song from the 60s? Oh, it's sitting here to bring that. Okay, so don't do that to me anymore. Okay. No. It's a four-letter word that begins with A, Aram, A-R-A-M. Aram and Syria, Aramaic and Syrians, or Aramea and Syria, these things are one and the same. Just depends on the period of time that you're talking about. And both terms are going to be used in Scripture as well. So you'll get used to that. And Damascus is the capital city, as we just said a moment ago. Okay, then Ethiopia is going to be addressed under the term Cush, C-U-S-H. Egypt is going to be addressed very singularly and is also going to be then tied to Ethiopia as well. So we get that 20th chapter, and those two are kind of just put together. But Ethiopia is a separate country. It is actually named first, and then Egypt at far greater length, but the two are also linked together. And then we have Edom, Arabia, Judah, and its capital city, Jerusalem, of course, and then Tyre. So the nation's prophecies deal with these 10 nations. And out of these 10 nations, how many of them have to do with God's chosen people, the Jews? Just this one, Judah. And it's not the first, and it's not the last. It's just put in with the rest of them there toward the end of the nation's prophecies of 13 through 23. So now, here's our last chart. I don't believe I've shown you this particular map before. I'm always looking for new maps. I always try to bring you something, you know, new and different. I'm not even going to zoom in on this one. But as you look at it, here is your Red Sea today. What was it called back in old times? Add another E. The Reed Sea. Which, with the crossing from this area right here of the Jews after their captivity in Egypt, as they're coming back across here, crossing of the Reed Sea, also Red Sea, you know, some think they can narrow down the area anyway because there is a very flat, marshy area through there that would be suggestive, you know, of an area of reed. But at any rate, here's our Red Sea. Over here is the Persian Gulf. And this line right through here that then makes all of this area darker, that is the furthest extent of the Babylonian Empire. Now, what they don't do on this map, and it's a good idea for you to just be aware, I have other maps that do, they actually did for a time push down here into that Nile River Valley, and they took over parts of Egypt. So on this map, they're calling that the fullest extent of the Babylonian Empire. I argue that they actually got a little bit farther, you know, to the west there. But at any rate, now I'm hoping you'll be a little bit surprised. When we think about the Babylonian Empire, we call it a world empire, and it was. We recognize its vast influence in biblical times, but it's also really not all that big, is it? So when you see it marked out like this, for all the power and influence that it has over biblical events, it didn't even make it very far off into Turkey there. It never captured all of Egypt.
you know, and it didn't hardly get past, you know, the Tigris and Euphrates areas to the east.
What I'd like for you to see right here, though, is that everything that's going to be discussed in chapters 13 through 23 is within those boundaries.
Now, Babylon's coming off. Babylon's getting on up there. They're not the big boys yet in Isaiah's time. Who is? Who's the superpower then? That's Assyria in Isaiah's day. Later, Babylon's going to come in, and they're going to be really serious, but not yet, and really not for almost 100 more years. So they're just growing now out of Babylon, the city itself. But if I just start over here in this area, Elam, that you'll read about in these chapters, is off on the very far east over here of the Babylonian Empire. Medo-Persia, of course, is something we'll be hearing about later. They're the ones that conquered Babylon. Well, it was in Lenny's material last week, chapter 13. So there's your Medo-Persia in that area. And then Damascus is the capital city of Aram or Syria. Okay. Here are the Ammonites immediately below them. But the first thing we'll talk about tonight, chapter 15, is Moab. And then Edom. Here's Judah. The Philistines, who were just very briefly mentioned last week in 13, okay, is right along the coast here, constant problem, of course, for the Jews. And then here's Tyre over here, just to the north, of course,
never a big, huge, influential thing, but the city, you know, is really big. So, what I'd like for you to do, everybody come over to chapter 13. Now, Lenny may have done this, you know, I can't remember, but if you'll look at chapter 13, mark it then somehow. Chapter 13 through 23 are the nation's prophecies. And then I'll give you the list one more time. So I wrote it in the margin of my Bible here. But they are Babylon, if you want to write them in the margin, the 10 nations are Babylon, Philistia, just a couple of verses, Moab, two chapters, there's a lot on them we'll see tonight, Damascus, which, of course, is Syria or Aram as well, Ethiopia, and then Egypt, Edom, Arabia, Judah, and Tyre. Judah and Tyre. Okay? So, when I say all these are within the boundaries of the Babylonian Empire, now you see why I say, well, Egypt was in there too. Map didn't show us, but, you know, Egypt was at one point inside their influence in later years after Isaiah. And then the other one I didn't mention here, this word is Arabian Desert. You know, here's our Arabia. So, all of it within the Babylonian Empire there. All right, that being the case, then I'm just going to go ahead and turn the TV off. We don't have any more slides here this evening. That's the first time I've called that a TV. I think I can only see the screen until tonight. Ahab, Aram, you guys got kind of hinged here this evening. Okay, so now, with all that in view, what I'd also like for you to do is, well, first let me ask you, because I won't take the time if you don't do this, but I think it is really helpful if you use a little cloud or a square, rectangle, you know, some way of marking each of those 10 nations / cities. How many of you actually do that, write that kind of stuff in your Bible when I say, hey, this would be a good idea? Well, that's quite a few. Okay, so let's do that. It's going to take a while tonight, but I'm not going to do it again later. So what I did, I chose pink in my Bible many years ago for the nations. So every time an actual name of one of those nations pops up, I'm going to show you where it is, and you use your cloud or your rectangle or whatever you do to mark it. So in chapter 13:1, Babylon is mentioned there. 13:1, Babylon. 13:19, verse 19 is Babylon. Pick it out of the verse, 19. Chapter 14 and verse 4, there's Babylon again, so highlight Babylon in 14:4. And then in 14:22, there's Babylon again. Pick it out, it's right in the middle of the verse. 14:22. And then if you'll come on over to 14:29, there's Philistia. Now, the Philistines only last to the end of that chapter, but the word is used one more time in verse 31. So if you do this highlighting, it'll just jump off the page. You'll be able to find these nations very, very quickly. So Philistia is in 14:29 and 14:31. Then, we'll be starting in a moment, 15:1 has the word Moab. 15:2 has the word Moab. 15:4, 15:5, and they're all in chapter 15. So verse 8, verse 9, chapter 16, and verses, all again Moab, 2, chapter 16, verse 4, verse 6, verse 7, twice. Chapter 16 now, after verse 7, Moab is in verse 11. Moab in verse 12. And Moab once each in the last two verses of that chapter, 13 and 14. So chapter 16, verses 13 and 14, there's Moab in each of those two verses. All right, chapter 17, Damascus is in the first verse. So highlight Damascus in the first verse. And again, in the third verse, 17:3. And then chapter 18, little tiny chapter there, only got seven verses. There's Ethiopia, but it's called Cush. Cush in your Bible is Ethiopia there in the first verse, last word of the first verse. So what I usually do there, you know, I draw a little arrow, and then in parenthesis I write Ethiopia. So every time I see Cush, you know, it reminds me, oh yeah, that's Ethiopia, which bordered on Egypt. Okay, only time you have anything in that 18th chapter, chapter 19 and verse 1 has Egypt. So, in chapter 19, the word Egypt is used just an awful lot. You'll find it in verse 12, right at the end. Verse 13, right at the end. Verse 14, there in the middle. Verse 15, in the middle. 16, it's actually Egyptians, but we'll call that good. 17, we're in chapter 19 at verse 17 for Egypt. Verse 18, verse 19, verse 20, verse 21, verse 22, verse 23, and verse 25. Oh, there's 24 also. So every single verse from 16 to the end of the chapter has got the word Egypt in it somewhere. And then comes this duality in chapter 20. Chapter 20 and verse 3, at the very end, you have Egypt and Cush. And then in verse 4, you have Egypt and Cush. And then at the end of verse 4, you have Egypt, which is immediately followed verse 5 with Cush, and then Egypt again. So I highlighted both Egypt and Cush each time they appear in verses 3, 4, and 5. Then we're done with those two. I'm sorry, somebody asked a question. I hear something. Okay, chapter 21 is the wilderness by the sea in verse 1, but I know that doesn't ring much for people, so you can highlight that. Maybe put in parenthesis Babylon. It is identified as Babylon in verse 9. But verse 1 says, the oracle concerning. So you know you're starting new material there. In the wilderness of the sea, everything that follows there, finally you get the name in verse 9, fallen is Babylon. And then like Philistia, in verses 11 and 12, Edom has only two verses worth of prophecy. But there it is, Edom in verse 11. And again, Arabia's only got five verses, but in verse 13 there, chapter 21, there's Arabia, 21:13, Arabia. And then we got to do the same thing in 22 that we did with 21. Who can tell me what the Valley of Vision is? 22:1, what's the Valley of Vision? Well, if you look down at 22:8, it's Judah. And if you look at verse 10, it's Jerusalem. And if you look at 21, it's the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Okay? So this valley of vision is in Judah / Jerusalem. Yes?
In 21:11,
mm-hmm.
I have the version against Duma,
D-U-M-A-H. Correct. And Duma is the Hebrew word for Edom, as opposed to what would then be an Edomite word, you know, and that's why they translated Edom, because that rings a better bell for us. But you're right, Duma, depending on your translation. Arabia in 21:13. The Valley of Vision in chapter 22, verse 1, is Judah. So I wrote Judah next to that expression in my Bible, and then I put 22:8, 21, so I would know to go find those to identify it. And then in chapter 23, the last of this nations section, you have Tyre in verse 1. T-Y-R-E in verse 1. You have Tyre in verse 5. You have Tyre in verse 8. Tyre appears in verse 15. And finally at verse 17. Now, brother, I know I'm always nervous when I do this, and it's kind of a technical thing, but I am really convinced, you know, that paper is better than electronics. Now, I can't live without my software. I do all my study with my software, but I can't get around in the software, you know, like I can in my Bible. So I'd highly recommend, you know, you still work with paper Bibles, bring paper Bibles here, take these notes, and I realize, you know, it's just paperwork, but it's so helpful, you know. So helpful, because now you can just glance at the page, go boom, 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 boom. You can identify the nations, the verses that are tied to them. You know, and most Bibles are not going to do that for you, so you know, it just leaps off the page. Judy?
Oh, I think it's interesting. You mentioned Tyre a few times. She was a great quartet. Had a lot of, I mean, it was a great city before, and it was decimated, and it was prophesied. We did see a place in Aaron, and that's exactly what it is today.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's Ezekiel's prophecy. Ezekiel is extremely specific about what's going to happen to Tyre. And Tyre was a tremendously major seaport, and that because they had an island about half mile off the coast, so it created shelter. And is of course, Tyre, of course, being up north in what today we would call Lebanon. And so June's absolutely right. Ezekiel's going to fill that out for us. From the days of the Babylonian captivity, about 100 years after Isaiah's time, in his prophecy. Okay, so now let's rip and roar, brethren, because in chapter 15 through 23, you got 10 nations. Essentially, the material about them is all the same. It's just different verbiage. I'm going to crush you. And then very poetically, you find out how they get crushed. Okay? None of these are godly nations, and that includes Judah. There's going to be a smattering of material here that appears to have always that hint of a promise for the distant future. A little bit of messianic material in there. But what is very frustrating for us today is that in addition to the highlighted nations that are formally declared to be what the prophecies are talking about, there are a host of cities and rivers and roads and geographical, you know, landmarks that the majority of which, something like three-quarters of which, we don't have any idea where they are today. The prophecies were fulfilled. These people were destroyed. Their nations have gone to dust, and they've been covered by the dust of millenniums now. And consequently, what was vibrant and real and so understandable and frightening and just, you know, amazing for a faithful Jew at that time, or at least readily identifiable by the people of Isaiah's time, is lost to us now. And so we in this section, especially, brethren, need to recognize that the purpose of the prophecies is clear as a bell. But we don't have to dig down into all the particulars. Now, if you want to, there's plenty of commentaries that'll do that.
Young's is considered, you know, the premier of them all, although I argue that Homer Haley's commentary on Isaiah is absolutely indispensable. But, you know, Young's is three volumes, you know, if you really want to dig. And they'll spend pages telling you, you know, about this, that, and another play. So tonight, you know, if you feel like you really need to know, and I seem to be passing over something you'd like to know about, don't hesitate to raise your hand. But the nature of the material tonight, I think, will allow us to cover quite a few chapters. And if we really get to going, maybe even all 11 of them. It's about the nations that will eventually be enveloped by the Babylonian Empire, which, as you learned from Lenny last week in chapter 13, will itself be destroyed by the Medo-Persians, who are named in chapter 13. So it's very contemporary and now lost to us, much of it. Now that does not make it useless. That does not make it uninteresting. That does not mean you should skip over it the next time you're reading Isaiah. I'd read Isaiah more rather than less. Today, you know, I'm telling you how I study. You all have learned how I study. You know, I go out, I walk 10 miles today. Today I listened to Homer Haley on Isaiah, and then I decided for the last 3 hours I was just going to listen to these chapters. I listened to all of these chapters about four times in the New King James Version. I listened six or seven times in the New American Standard. I read it, I read it, I read it. And you know, it was more interesting to me, or I listened, you know, with each reading and with each listening then. You know, it's marvelous material. It's faith-building material. But the details are details that matter only to the people of that time. And those details are a massive amount of details. We're going to go really, really quickly. But I do want to read everything. So we're going to start with 15:1. Here is the oracle concerning Moab. Surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. Surely in a night, Ker of Moab is devastated and ruined. They've gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the high places, to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. In their streets they've girded themselves with sackcloth. On their housetops and in their squares, everyone is wailing, dissolved in tears. Heshbon and Elealeh also cry out. Their voice is heard all the way to Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles within him. My heart cries out for Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zoar and Eglath Shelishiah. They go up to the ascent of Luhith weeping. Surely on the road to Haranaim they raise a cry of distress over their ruin. For the waters of Nimrim are desolate. Surely the grass is withered, the tender grass died out. There's no green thing. Therefore the abundance which they've acquired and stored up, they carry off over the brook of Arabim. For the cry of distress has gone around the territory of Moab. Its wail goes as far as Eglaim, and its wailing even to Beerilim, for the waters of Dimon are full of blood. Surely I'll bring added woes upon Dimon, a lion upon the fugitives of Moab and upon the remnant of the land. Now, before we get into chapter 16, how much commentary does that mean? Dibon is a city. Anything else you want to know? It's on the northern border of Moab. Although it appears, and that was one thing I should have kept up on the screen, I guess, please bear in mind, brethren, that few nations of the Old Testament times are anything like the nations of today. Very seldom today does somebody say, uh-oh, we're going to have to change the world map because we got a new country. When was the last time that happened? Okay. But they're not significant, and it's rare. Very few nations as well have been so large or so geographically protected as the United States, for instance. So how much have our borders changed? Been a long while. Yeah, I know there was westward expansion and all of that, but in all of our lifetimes, you know, this is what it is. Maybe a few of us remember Alaska and Hawaii. No. See, not so in those days. What about all their borders then? Very porous and under constant attack and ebb and flow and flux, you know, as the nations were constantly fighting all the time. And so it just purely depends on what moment in time that you're talking about a particular prophecy as to where, for instance, Moab's boundaries are. Nebo was mentioned, though. Now, Nebo is a name that you might remember. What do you know about Nebo? There's a Mount Nebo, isn't there? Mount Nebo would be very far north of the traditional borders of Moab that you'd see on most maps, but there were times when the Moabites had land up that far. And Mount Nebo is where? Mount Nebo sits on the eastern side of the Jordan River, immediately adjacent to where it dumps into the Dead Sea. Who stood on Mount Nebo? Moses stood on Mount Nebo, and what could he see from there? He could see the whole land. And I stood there. Donna stood there in 2010 with me. Farrell Jenkins told us at that time he'd been there many, many, many times, and it was the clearest day he'd ever seen in 42 years. It is in the country of Jordan today. Up right close to the border, because it is, you know, the Jordan River. And when you stand there, sure enough, you can see vast reaches of the Dead Sea. You can see across right there that green oasis that is Jericho. You can look on up the Jordan River Valley, and you can see all the way. It's wonderful. It's amazing. It just makes you tremble. You know, when you stand and realize Moses was here. All the Israelites were here. And they were looking down on Jericho. There it is, right there. You can see it, just a few miles away. Okay? So, there. I mentioned Nebo. What else do you want to know about chapter 15?
Just a historical note. Hysterical, maybe. Moab came out of Lot.
So yeah, thank you so much, and I forgot to do that. At the top of chapter 15, I'm so glad you brought that to mind. I also have a note. The Moabites, as Ron just said, they are descendants, direct descendants of one of Lot's daughters. Famous Lot, okay, whose wife turned into Saul. Okay, that's Genesis chapter 19, verses 36 through 38. So at the top of 15, there, 15:1, I certainly, as Ron suggests, I have you write down there, Moabites, descendants of Lot, Genesis 19, verses 36 through 38. Thanks so much. Yeah, that is important, of course. And, of course, all these nations, you know, are tied together, going back to Adam and Eve, but some of them with fairly close, you know, ties in more recent times. Okay, now, in chapter 16, tell me what the, somebody just glance down the page and tell me, what's chapter 16 about? Who's being discussed there? Moab. How do you know that? Because you just highlighted it. It's everywhere in chapter 16. So it doesn't say that in the first verse, but it's a continuation of chapter 15. So now we can do 16, same way we did 15. Send the tribute lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah by way of the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. What's the daughter of Zion always talking about? It's either talking about literally the women of what nation? Israel, where Mount Zion is. Or it's just talking about, when it says to the mountain of the daughter of Zion, then it's referencing the nation. So, send the tribute lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah by way of the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. I do not understand this prophecy, nor do I believe anybody else does today. It's just a great mystery. There's all kinds of ideas people have, but what was readily understandable to those people is now entirely lost to us. I know that in verse 2 it says, then, like fleeing birds or scattered nestlings, the daughters of Moab will be at the fords of the Arnon. What is the Arnon? The border of Moab. And if you have fleeing people scattering like birds at the Arnon, then what have you got? You've got the Moabites being driven out of their land. They've lost their country, and they're just scattering to the winds, and they're crossing their borders. Their homes are lost.
But what is the tribute lamb? Who's the ruler of the land? What was going to be accomplished by that in verse 1? Brethren, nobody knows. I just don't get it. Isaiah knew, I think. And he probably explained it to people, but he didn't tell me. Okay. But it's still about Moab. Verse 3. Give us advice. Make a decision. Cast your shadow like night at high noon. Well, is that fun after Monday? We just had our whole eclipse day. And then in 4, let the outcasts of Moab stay with you. Be a hiding place to them from the destroyer. For the extortioner has come to an end. Destruction has ceased. Now, brother, when does destruction cease? When there isn't anything more to destroy. Okay? So it's a way of saying total destruction. Oppressors have completely disappeared from the land. A throne will even be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit on it in faithfulness in the tent of David. Moreover, he will seek justice and be prompt in righteousness. So what maybe are those two verses talking about? Could be a messianic prophecy. We have seen a lot of that kind of talk back in chapter 2, back in chapter 10 and 11. You know, we've seen that before. We're going to see a lot more of it. So, you know, very tempting there to think messianic. But could it refer to a physical king who would be reigning in Judah? Yeah, could. But I don't know which one it is. So these first verses in chapter 16 are just a mystery to us today. I wish I could tell you more about it. I wish somebody could tell me more about it. All the various commentaries I've read, everybody just scratches their head bald and says, you know, not sure.
The fact that it says that the king that will be prompted in righteousness, though, does rule out some of the kings that.
See, that's correct. Hezekiah is one of them, and he's contemporary with Isaiah. So that's why we can't pick. It could be so of Hezekiah.
David had a close tie with Moab, since his grandmother was from there, and on one occasion he fled Moab.
Love these Bible students. Okay. Moab's got close ties, and David fled there, as you just heard, and he had family that was living down there. And so, you know, there's ties, and we get inklings in Scripture. But never forget, whenever you're reading a Bible book, Lowell Williams, one of the first things he ever taught when Don and I moved up there in 1975, we hear it over and over and over again. He would say, particularly with regard to New Testament epistles, but it applies everywhere else. Lowell would say, when you're reading these Bible books, you are reading somebody else's mail. Have you heard that before? Jared probably. It's a famous saying among us, and among everybody else, and that's what you're doing. But whenever you read somebody else's mail from 2,000 years ago, you really don't get it all, do you? You know, there's stuff that you can't get. So, in context and in its time, readily understandable. That beats me. Now, verse 6, though, we have heard of the pride of Moab, an excessive pride, of his arrogance, pride, and fury. His idle boasts are false. Therefore Moab shall wail, every one of Moab shall wail, you shall moan for the raisin cakes of Kir Hareseth, as those who are utterly stricken. And the fields of Heshbon have withered, the vines of Sibmah. The lords of the nations have trampled down its choice clusters, which reached as far as Jazer and wandered to the deserts. Its tendrils spread themselves out and passed over the sea. Therefore, I will weep bitterly for Jazer, for the vine of Sibmah. I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh, for the shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen away. Gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards also there will be no cries of joy or jubilant shouting. No treader treads out wine in the presses, for I have made the shouting to cease. Therefore my heart intones like a harp for Moab, my inward feelings for Kir Hareseth. So it will come about when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself upon his high place and comes to his sanctuary to pray, that he will not prevail. This is the word which the Lord spoke earlier concerning Moab, But now the Lord speaks, saying, within 3 years, as a hired man would count them, the glory of Moab will be degraded along with all his great population, and his remnant will be very small and impotent. Now, that's a specific prophecy. It's within 3 years of the way a hired man would count years. Now, if you've been hired on a contract to do a 3-year job, today I met a guy in Alton Baker Park who's been working in that park for 30 years. A hired man working in the park. Suppose he's thinking about retirement now, and he goes, well, I think I'll sign a contract for 3 years. Will he be working in that park 3 years and 1 day from today? No. Because a hired man, how does he count his time? Very precisely. And he doesn't work any more than he has to. And if you're the one that's hiring somebody, how would you count the years of a hired man? You want to pay him for work he doesn't do? Oh. So, very specific. Now, this prophecy was fulfilled in 3 years of whenever Isaiah said so. Now that you've read chapters 15 and 16, when did Isaiah say so? He didn't. Now he was standing there telling these people within 3 years, you know, they could start their hourglass. They could get out their sundial. Okay, it'd be 3 years. But he didn't date it, because it doesn't apply to us. So I don't know. It's undated. Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib all destroyed Moab in various invasions. I don't sure enough was fulfilled. Which one of those three verse 14 is talking about today is not possible to know, because God didn't tell us. Isaiah didn't tell us. I don't know. Chapter 17 is about what? Damascus. Behold, Damascus is about to be removed from being a city. It'll become a fallen ruin. The cities over Arawar are forsaken. They will be for flocks to lie down. It's funny because my note on the other side bled through. Now I can't even read it. They will be for flocks to lie down in. There will be no one to frighten. The fortified city will disappear from Ephraim, and sovereignty from Damascus, and the remnant of Aram. They will be like the glory of the sons of Israel, declares the Lord of hosts. By the way, Ephraim had some territory that was where? Over in the area of Syria, Aram. Now it will come about in that day that the glory of Jacob will fade. Fatness of his flesh will become lean. It will be even like a reaper gathering the standing grain as his arm harvests the ears, or it will be like one gleaning ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Yet gleanings will be left in it like the shaking of an olive tree. Two or three olives on the topmost bough. Four or five on the branches of a fruitful tree, declares the Lord, the God of Israel. That day a man will have regard for his Maker, and his eyes will look to the Holy One of Israel, and he will not have regard for the altars, the work of his hands, nor will he look to that which his fingers have made, even the Asherim and incense stands. In that day their strong cities will be like forsaken places in the forest, or like branches which they have abandoned before the sons of Israel. The land will be a desolation, for you have forgotten the God of your salvation. Have not remembered the rock of your refuge. Therefore you plant delightful plants and set them with vine slips of a strange God. In the day that you plant it, you carefully fence it in. In the morning you bring your seed to blossom, but the harvest will be a heap in a day of sickliness and incurable pain. Now, brethren, at verse 4, if you want to make a note, Syria fell in 732 B.C. Syria fell 732 to Assyria. 10 years later, Israel, which goes by the names also Samaria or Ephraim, as in this text, Assyria came and whooped up on Samaria / Ephraim / Israel in what year? 722 BC. So, here's a prophecy that speaks of an invasion of the Assyrians, which is going to get into Syria and farther, and so Israel, the northern kingdoms, get caught up in this prophecy as well. Now, at verse 12, if you'd like to make a note, what we're talking about is an Assyrian invasion. So at verse 12, just make a note, this has already been prophesied by Isaiah in this book, and we've already talked about it. Isaiah 8, verses 5 through 8, talks about this same Assyrian invasion. And chapter 10, verses 5 through 27, also talks about this Assyrian invasion. So I'm just going to go very quickly. Verse 12, "Alas, the uproar of many peoples who roar like the roaring of the seas, and the rumbling of nations who rush on like the rumbling of mighty waters. The nations rumble on like the rumbling of many waters, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away, and be chased like chaff in the mountains before the wind, or like whirling dust before a gale. At evening time, behold, terror. Before morning, they are no more. Such the portion of those who plunder us, and the lot of those who pillage us." End of prophecy. Okay, well, there's bad times coming, you know. And whoever the us is there is apparently Ephraim and Damascus / Syria / Aram. Chapter 18 only has 7 verses. To whom is it addressed? Cush, which is, today we would say, Ethiopia. "Alas, O land of whirring wings." Well, I don't know. Is it locusts? I don't know what the whirring wings are. And once again, here's a colloquial expression of the day that is lost to us. "But it lies beyond the rivers of Cush, which sends envoys by the sea, even in papyrus vessels on the surface of the waters." Oh, that region's getting to be, you know, recognizable now. "Go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth." I haven't got a clue, nor does anybody else. Tall, I understand. Smooth, I guess, means hairless. They don't need Norelco. But who are they? I don't know. "To a people feared far and wide, a powerful and impressive nation whose land the rivers divide." Tigris Euphrates comes to mind. Could be Babylon. "All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on earth, as soon as the standard is raised on the mountains, you'll see it. As soon as the trumpet is blown, you will hear it. For thus the Lord has told me, I will look for my dwelling place quietly, like a dazzling heat in the sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, as soon as the bud blossoms and the flower becomes a ripening grape, then he'll cut off the sprigs with the pruning knives and remove and cut away the spreading branches. They'll be left together for mountain birds of prey and for beasts of the earth. The birds of prey will spend the summer feeding on them, and all the beasts of the earth will spend harvest time on them. At that time, a gift of homage will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth, even from a people feared far and wide, powerful and oppressive nation, whose land the rivers divide, to the place, the name of the Lord of hosts, even Mount Zion." Now, brethren, again, I don't know. It's in a last, in verse 1, for Ethiopia, which lies beyond the rivers of Cush. Well, but that is a designation for Ethiopia. So it's not the land beyond Ethiopia. It's designating the borders, the rivers. And then we've got, you know, more destruction for the nations. And once again, 7 just drives you crazy. You know, to the place, the name of the Lord of hosts, even Mount Zion. What I'd suggest, brethren, is that apparently this is the onslaught of Assyria, which, by the way, in Hezekiah's time, not only came and took Syria to its west, Assyria took Syria, and then swept on down and took, you know, the 10 northern tribes, but it went all the way down into Judah until it had what? Surrounded Jerusalem. And then what happened? 185,000 guys croaked in the night. Snapper goes home to get killed by his two sons. Okay? Probably that's what it's talking about. But, you know, a little bit obscure. So, let me take the last 5 minutes and do all of chapter 19, big as it is, and then we'll close it, you know, with start next week with 20, because it is a very unique part of this. But what's the oracle of chapter 19 about? It says so over and over and over again, doesn't it? The oracle concerning Egypt. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. Okay? Now we're beginning to get used to this expression. Does God himself actually put reins on a cloud and saddle, you know, and sit on a cloud? No, but it's an expression that means what? Somebody riding on a cloud is somebody you can't stop, can't do anything about. He's coming whether you like it or not, because nobody flies in those days. It's just a figurative expression that an unconquerable foe is coming to conquer you. This is the Lord on his swift cloud. The idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. So I will incite Egyptians against Egyptians. They'll each fight against his brother, and each against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. Then the spirit of the Egyptians will be demoralized within them. I will confound their strategy, so that they will resort to idols and ghosts of the dead and to mediums and spiritists. Moreover, I will deliver the Egyptians into the hand of a cruel master, and a mighty king will rule over them, declares the Lord. And brethren, here we go again. Assyria did this, Babylon did this, Persia did this, Greece did this, Rome did this. All of them will conquer Egypt in their time. So did Isaiah date the prophecy? No, he didn't. Can I know which one he has in mind? No, I don't. And they're all the same, aren't they? Every time you get up on your high places offering sacrifices to another god, whatever nation you are, you'll pay for it. Verse 5. And the waters from the sea will dry up, and the river will be parched and dry, and the canals will emit a stench. The streams of Egypt, and this one, I got a pink highlighter, that's what I'm using. There's one right there in verse 6, I forgot to tell you that. Egypt. Will thin out and dry up. The reeds and rushes will rot away. The bulrushes by the Nile, by the edge of the Nile, all the sown fields by the Nile will become dry, be driven away, and be no more. The fishermen will lament, and all those who cast a line into the Nile will mourn, and those who spread nets on the waters will pine away. Jude, who's that sound like? Sounds like Tyre out of Ezekiel. The Lord takes care of business in similar ways in different places. This time it's the Nile River. Verse 9. Moreover, the manufacturers of linen made from combed flax and the weavers of white cloth will be utterly dejected, and the pillars of Egypt will be crushed. All the hired laborers will be grieved in soul. The princes of Zoan, which was a big city where some of the kings ruled from in the course of time over the very long Egyptian history, are mere fools. The advice of Pharaoh's wisest advisors has become stupid. How can you men say to Pharaoh, I am a son of the wise, a son of ancient kings? Well then, where are your wise men? Please let them tell you and let them understand what the Lord of hosts has purposed against Egypt. The princes of Zoan have acted foolishly. The princes of Memphis, another major city to the west of Zoan, which also had been a ruling city for pharaohs at various times, those princes are deluded. Who are the cornerstone of her tribes, have led Egypt astray. The Lord has mixed within her a spirit of distortion. They've led Egypt astray in all that it does. Shades of the 2 Thessalonians 2, where it says the Lord will send upon them a strong delusion. Okay? That's the same idea that we got going on here. If you will not serve the Lord, he'll give you what you want. Delusion. 15. There will be no work for Egypt, which its head or its tail, palm branches, or bulrush may do. That day the Egyptians will become like women. They will tremble and be in dread because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he is going to wave over them. The land of Judah will become a terror to Egypt. Everyone to whom it is mentioned will be in dread of it because of the purpose of the Lord of hosts, which he is purposing against them. That day, five cities in the land of Egypt will be speaking the language of Canaan and swearing allegiance to the Lord of hosts. One will be called the City of Destruction. Don't know who those cities are. Don't know what the City of Destruction is. And that day, there will be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt and a pillar to the Lord near its border. It will become a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt, for they will cry to the Lord because of oppressors, and He will send them a Savior and a champion, and He will deliver them. Thus the Lord will make Himself known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day. They will even worship with sacrifice and offering, and will make a vow to the Lord and perform it. The Lord will strike Egypt, striking but healing, so they will return to the Lord, and He will respond to them and will heal them. In that day, same day as verse 16, same day as verse 19, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrians will come into Egypt, the Egyptians into Assyria, the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians, and that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, you know, as if in a covenant, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, "Blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." And I know what that's talking about. So come back next week if you want to find out.